I guessed this was where they kept their prisoners, though it was still a lot nicer than where the Malago lived. At a turn in the corridor, Alder motioned for us to stop. He took a cautious peek around the corner, then turned back to us.
"There is good news and bad news," he said. "The cell where Press is being held is being guarded. That means he is still there."
"Okay," I said. "What's the bad news?"
"The bad news is that there are 6 knights keeping guard."
Uh-oh. I took a peek around the corner to see for myself. Alder was right. There were 6 guards there, and these weren't fat and sassy Bedouins either. These were solid-looking knights. Each was dressed the same as we were and had the same club weapons hanging from their belts as the knight in the kitchen. This was bad. There was no way we were getting past those guys. I snuck back to the other two, looked right at Lore, and said,
"Don't even think about taking those guys on."
"We must do something," countered Lore, "or this was all for nothing."
Alder added,
"And the equinox is fast approaching."
"We gotta get the knights away from the door," I said. "You know how this place works, Alder. What can we do that would make them leave their post?" Alder thought, and then said,
"It would take some sort of emergency, something they had to respond to quickly."
"Keep going," I said. "Think." Alder looked around. He had no clue. But then his eye caught something near the ceiling. He stared at it for a moment and smiled. Lore and I both looked up to where his gaze was fixed. What we saw was something that looked like a pipe. It was about 6 inches in diameter and ran along the wall right by the ceiling.
"What's that?" I asked.
"You have something in your bag," said Alder. "It has a handle with a jagged metal blade."
I knew exactly what he meant. I dug into my pack and pulled out the camp saw. This one was even better than the one I asked you for, Mark. All I wanted was the small saw from my dad's workshop, but you gave me this coolio thing that folded in half to fit in the pack. Alder opened it up, locked the saw blade, and felt the sharpness of the teeth.
"This is for cutting?"
he asked.
"Yeah," I answered. "What are you thinking?"
Alder looked back up at the pipe in the ceiling and said,
"That carries water throughout the fortress,"
he answered. He then looked at us with a devilish smile. It took me a second, but I figured out what his plan was and smiled back.
"You can cut through that thing?"
I asked.
"Like soft fruit,"
was his confident answer. Lore still didn't get it.
"Why would you do that?"
she asked angrily. She was ticked that we were a few steps ahead of her. Alder answered,
"I will go a few corridors over and cut out a section of the water carrier."
"It'll make a mess," I said, enjoying the thought.
"Yes, it will,"
he said, enjoying the idea as much as I was.
"And of course, the missing piece will not be found anywhere."
"That's perfect, dude. Go," I said. Alder took off running in the opposite direction, away from the prison corridor. Lore and I hid ourselves in a small room around the corner, waiting for the excitement to begin.
"I did not think we would get this far," she said.
"Neither did I," I replied. We waited a few minutes, but nothing happened. I was getting nervous. Lore seemed calm. She had her game face on. Maybe she was used to this pre-battle moment, but my stomach was a knot of tension. I couldn't take it anymore and jumped up.
"I gotta see how he's doing," I said.
"Pendragon, no!"
she hissed and tried to grab me. But there was no way I could wait there any longer. I moved quickly in the direction that Alder had gone, peeking down the corridors at each junction, expecting to see him. Finally, I rounded a corner, and there he was. Alder was standing on a table, sawing away at the pipe. He had already sawed all the way through once, and water was leaking down on him. There was a pool of water growing on the floor. But the best was yet to come. With a few final pulls on the saw, he sliced through a second time and pulled down a chunk of pipe about 2 feet long. The second he pulled it down, water started gushing out like a berserk fire hydrant. Alder got doused and was nearly knocked over by the force. I sure hoped this was fresh water, not sewage. That would have been nasty. Effective, but nasty. Alder got his bearings, caught sight of me, and held up the hunk of pipe triumphantly. Then suddenly,
ah!
A Bedouin woman had rounded the corner on the far end and saw the waterworks. The alarm had been officially sounded. Alder tucked the pipe away like a football and ran in the opposite direction from me. I was now in the wrong spot and started back to Lore. I had to force myself to walk. I didn't want anyone thinking that I was running away from the scene of the crime, which is exactly what I was doing. It was a good thing, too, because no sooner did I slow down than I saw the team of knights that had been guarding Uncle Press come running toward me. Or should I say, toward the screaming woman. They ran past me as if I wasn't even there. I really wanted to stay and watch the madness as they tried to stop the water. But that's not why I was here. It was time to spring Uncle Press. When I got back to Lore, she was up and peering around the corridor toward the cell. She sensed I was near and turned to face me.
"There is only one guard left," she said. "It is my turn."
She reached behind her back, and from underneath her jacket, she pulled a smaller version of her wooden stick weapon. I had no idea she had it. Sneaky. She was all set to charge, but I stopped her.
"No,"
I said as strongly as possible.
"They don't know we're here yet. The longer we can be secret, the better chance we have of getting out." "There is no other way, Pendragon," she said, seething.
She wanted to fight. I took a quick glance around the corridor to see the guard standing there. Further down, the corridor ended at a balcony. My guess was that this balcony overlooked the ocean. I had an idea.
"Can you get to that balcony without him knowing?" I asked.
Lore took a quick look, turned to see that there was a parallel corridor behind us, and said,
"Yes. Then go. I'll send him to you."
Lore wanted to ask how, but I pushed her to go before she had the chance. I figured if the laser pointer trick worked once, it would work again. So I waited a few minutes to make sure Lore was in position, then took the pointer out of my pocket. When I clicked it on, the beam didn't work. I clicked it a few more times. I banged it. I took out the battery to clean it. But nothing worked. It was dead. And so was I. I didn't know how much longer the other knights would be occupied with the water geyser, and Lore was waiting for me to do something. I dug back in my pack, looking for an answer. And I found it! It was the radio-controlled stun cycle! If the batteries failed on this baby, then we were out of luck. I wasn't as good with the stun cycle as with my four-wheel Humvee, but I understand why you guys couldn't go to my house to get it. It was going to be the stun cycle or nothing. I still remember the day you got this for your birthday, Mark. We both picked up on the radio controls pretty quick and had that cycle taking air off ramps in no time. The plastic helmet on the driver still had the scars from all the times he landed on his head. But I wasn't planning any tricks with him today. All I wanted him to do was drive straight and smooth. If I could pull that off, then we might have a chance. So I took the little motorcycle out of my pack, reached around the corner of the corridor, and put him on the floor. My plan was to send it slowly past the guard, but I didn't want him to see me standing there with the radio controls. I had to do this blind. I took a breath, then pushed the forward stick. The motorcycle hummed to life with that familiar whine. I wasn't sure how fast it was going, but I couldn't take the chance of looking too soon. If I sent it off course, I was dead. If I sent it too slowly, the guard might just bend over and pick it up. So I forced myself to count to 10, then I peeked an eye around the corner. I saw exactly what I wanted to see. The guard was standing at the door, dumbfounded, staring at the little man on the motorcycle. I can't imagine what was going through his mind. I couldn't tell if he was curious or scared. Probably a little bit of both. I had the motorcycle moving on a perfectly straight line, headed for the far end of the corridor. So far, so good. But just as the cycle was about to roll past him, the guard took a step forward and reached down to pick it up. I quickly hit the throttle and the cycle shot ahead, just barely out of his grasp. Maybe I was better at this than I thought. This seemed to get the guard's curiosity up even further, and he walked after the cycle.
Perfect!
This was like playing a fish on a line. I teased him by slowing up. When he would bend down to pick it up, I shot it forward. The whole time he kept moving closer and closer to the balcony on the far end of the corridor where Lore was lying in wait. With one final push on the throttle, I accelerated the motorcycle forward and it shot out onto the balcony. The guard walked out behind it. He looked down, then hesitated because he expected it to move again, but it didn't. He stared at it for a second, then suddenly bent over and snatched it up with one quick move. But his victory was short-lived because he never stood up again. Lore jumped out and whacked him with her mini-stick. With two quick moves, she slammed the guy, pivoted, and sent him sailing over the rail into the ocean. Mission accomplished! And we hadn't given ourselves away! I quickly reached into my pocket and pulled out my walkie-talkie. "Get Alder!" I commanded, into the yellow walkie. Lore definitely heard me, because she took off running along the balcony and out of sight. I put my walkie-talkie away and looked to the cell door. There was nothing left between me and Uncle Press but that door, so I quickly grabbed my pack and ran for it. It was too much to expect that the door would be unlocked, and it wasn't. There was an old-fashioned keyhole, but of course I had no key, so I dug into my pack to look for something that might help me open the door. All I could come up with was the Swiss Army knife that I had nabbed back from Figgis. I opened up the awl blade and stuck it into the keyhole, figuring I might be able to turn the lock somehow, but it didn't work. I jammed the awl up and down desperately. If I couldn't open the lock, then maybe I could break it. I think that's exactly what happened, because with one final twist, the latch moved and the door opened. I was in! Or should I say, Uncle Press was out! "Uncle Press!" I shouted as I ran in. "It's me! We gotta get..." The small cell was empty. Uncle Press wasn't there. I didn't understand why it would be guarded if there was no one to guard. The answer came quickly. "Ah!" Somebody jumped me from behind. He leaped up on my back, wrapped his legs around my waist, and tried to wrestle me to the ground.
"Let me out of here, you filthy Bedouin pig!"
he shouted. The guy wasn't very heavy, or very strong for that matter. All I had to do was spin once and he went flying off. He landed on the hard floor with a loud thud that must have knocked the wind out of him. I looked down and saw that this definitely wasn't Uncle Press. It was a grimy little guy dressed in Malago skins. His hair and beard were incredibly long, which meant he'd been here for a long time. "Where's my uncle?" I shouted. The strange little man looked up at me with confusion in his eyes.
You are not Bedouin?" he asked.
"No, I'm here to get my uncle. Where is he?" The guy took a while to answer. I guess he wasn't used to this much excitement. Join the club, neither was I.
"You must be Pendragon," he said.
"Yes, and I'm looking for my uncle. Do you know where he is?"
"They took him," answered the Malago prisoner. "Early, before the suns came up. He is to be executed today."
Yeah, I knew that. This guy wasn't helping much. I didn't know where to turn. Uncle Press could be anywhere. My mind raced, but I didn't come up with a single answer. I was in total brain lock when my walkie-talkie came to life.
"Pendragon,"
came Alder's voice.
"I found Press. He is not in his cell."
I grabbed my walkie and said to him, "Yeah, I know. Where is he?"
"I am with him now,"
he came back.
"I will direct you to us. Hurry."
We were back in the game. I glanced at the Malago prisoner and said, "Now's your chance. Get out." Then I turned and ran out of the cell. I quickly ran back toward the mayhem that Alder had caused. The water was still gushing out of the pipes and the corridor was totally flooded. Knights and Novans worked together trying to stop the flow, but they were doing a lousy job. Good. It kept them busy. Alder then came through the walkie-talkie saying,
"Go back to the stairs and climb two more levels."
Got it. I did what I was told. But when I entered the stairwell, I saw something coming down below that nearly made my heart stop. Coming up fast from the lower level were a dozen knights. And these guys were in full battle gear, carrying spears. I think some kind of alarm must have finally sounded. They knew we were here. One of them looked up and saw me.
There he is!
Shouted the knight. Yep, they knew we were here. The knights began to run. There was no way I could outrace these guys, so I played my final card. I pulled the CD boombox out of the pack, held it in front of me, cranked the volume, and hit play. Instantly, the thrashing rock guitar blasted out of the speakers. It was like I had thrown a bomb at these guys. They froze in their tracks with a look of total shock on each and every face. They had never heard anything like this before, and probably never would again. They turned and fled back down the stairs in total panic. Under other circumstances, I would have thought this was pretty funny. Right now, it just felt like victory. I left the boombox on the stairs, figuring this would be as good as putting up a gate to keep them down there.
Pendragon, hurry!
Came Alder's voice through the walkie. As I started to run back up the stairs, I grabbed my walkie and called to him. I'm almost on the fourth level.
Turn left at the top and go to the end of the corridor,
he instructed.
We're hiding in the last room to the left, before the balcony.
I tucked the walkie away and ran to where he told me. My mind was working ahead to the next few moves. We had to find Lore and get out, but we couldn't get back out through the kitchen because I had the knights trapped down there. There had to be another way out. Hopefully Alder had one, because I sure didn't. I got to the top of the stairs, made the turn, and ran down the corridor. I realized briefly that this corridor was more ornate than any we had seen so far. There were huge sculptures and giant paintings on the walls. It would have been pretty cool if I weren't so scared out of my mind. But I had reached my destination. The last room on the left was where Alder and Uncle Press were waiting for me. Hopefully Lore was there too. I ran into the room and skidded to a sudden stop. It took all of a half second for me to realize that this had gone terribly wrong. I turned to run back out, but two Bedouin knights jumped in front of me, blocking the door. I was trapped. Slowly, I turned back to see Alder standing there holding the walkie-talkie. A knight had a spear to his throat. Alder looked as if he were about to cry.
I am sorry, Pendragon,
he cried.
They were going to kill her.
Two other knights were holding Lore. One had her arms, the other held a knife to her throat.
You should have let them, she spat out in defiance.
There were a few other people in the room, too. Seeing them is why I knew all was lost. One of them was Saint Dane, or Malos, as he calls himself here. He stood with his arms folded and a smug smile on his face. But it was the final person in the room who gave me the biggest surprise of all. This person was seated on a large, ornate throne that was decorated with cut pieces of glaze. I didn't need to be told who it was. This was the heir to the throne of the Bedouin. This was the monarch who had their father killed so they could begin their tyrannical rule over the Malago. This was the person who ordered the deaths of Malago as easily as ordering more glaze. This was Kagan's throne room, and seated on the throne was Kagan. The thing that surprised me, though, is that Kagan was a woman.
Hello, Pendragon, said Saint Dane. Lovely day for an execution, don't you think?
The one person missing from the room was Uncle Press.
Journal number 3. Continued. Denduron.
This is the Malago boy I have heard so much about, said Kagan with a sneer. His odor offends me.
Gee, thanks, lady. Nice to meet you, too. I have to describe to you guys what Kagan looked like, because she was a real piece of work. First off, she was fat. Not just baby fat chubby, we're talking gordo. I'll bet she kept that kitchen downstairs pretty busy. She wore a flowing yellow toga dress that didn't do much to hide her rolls of chub. Luckily, the dress went to the floor and had long sleeves, because I didn't think her arms and legs would be a pretty sight. The dress didn't hide her feet, though. She wore these sandals that her toes poked out of like stuffed sausages. Not a pleasant picture. She also had a double chin of fat that hung down over the neck of her dress. Ugh. I have no idea how old she was. She could have been 18 or 30 or any age in between. The fat stretched her skin so much that it gave her a smooth baby look. Of course, she wasn't a baby. She was a monstrous evil queen with fat toes. Everything about her was big. Her hands, her feet, her head, even her eyes. Oddly enough, with all of the size she had going on, her mouth was tiny. Such a little hole didn't belong on this immense, doughy face. She had long hair, too, but it wasn't shiny and combed. It hung down over her shoulders and looked like it hadn't been washed in a few months. Nice, huh? She was like some kind of bizarro cartoon sumo wrestler woman. She had multiple drapes of silver necklaces, bracelets that traveled halfway up her arms, and rings on every finger. She also had a tiara perched on top of her head that looked kind of stupid because it was too small. On any normal head, it would look fine, but her big old round greasy-haired dome made it look like a doll crown on a giant. Of course, all of the silver jewelry was adorned with glaze. The precious blue stones were cut in every shape and size imaginable. It must have taken the Malago miners a week to dig up this much glaze. Her throne was decorated with glaze as well. There were baseball-sized stones mounted all over the golden chair. As I took all of this in, I kept thinking about the transfer ceremony where that miner died because they hadn't brought up enough glaze. I can honestly say that I have never hated anyone in my life, but this lady was in line to be the first.
"Show me the toy,"
she commanded. Her voice was high and squeaky, like fingernails on a blackboard. The knight, who was holding Alder, grabbed his walkie-talkie and handed it to Kagan with a subservient bow. She took it and inspected it from all angles.
"What sort of magic is this?"
she asked. I couldn't resist. I took my walkie, hit the send button, and said,
"Put it down."
Bad move. Kagan let out a yelp and dropped the walkie like it was alive. It hit the floor with a clatter, and a knight immediately crushed it with his boot like an annoying bug. I stood there holding the second walkie, which was now totally useless, wishing I hadn't pulled that stunt. Kagan hoisted herself up out of her throne and waddled toward me, her jewelry jangling as she walked. She stared down at me with those big, round, black eyes, raised a meaty hand, then hauled off and slapped me across the face. Yow! That stung! But I wouldn't give her the benefit of letting her know how much, so I clenched my teeth and forced back my tears. I looked to Kagan, and oddly enough, it seemed as if she were holding back tears, too. She looked at her hand, then looked at me with genuine surprise and exclaimed,
"You hurt my hand."
Say what? Whose fault was that? I guess it was mine, because instantly two knights ran up to me and jammed the points of their spears in my neck. "Whoa, whoa!" I yelled. "Sorry, it won't happen again." What I wanted to say was, "Gee, sorry I hit your hand with my face, chubby." But I figured it wouldn't be a good idea to be a wise ass, especially when I had two spears at my throat.
"Let him go," commanded Malos Saint Dane.
The knights pulled their spears away, but stayed on either side of me. Kagan fell back into her throne, sobbing like a pouting baby. Malos comforted her by saying,
"Shall I call the surgeon, Your Majesty?"
"Surgeon? You gotta be kidding me."
"No,"
sniffled Kagan.
"I will be brave."
Give me a break. This lady was a piece of work, all right.
"He will be punished," Malos added, "along with his uncle."
This was bad. We came to rescue Uncle Press, and now it looked as if I was going to join him in whatever horrible fate they had planned. Some rescue, huh? Malos then left Kagan and walked to me.
"Press will be so happy to see you,"
he said to me with an oily smile. "Where is he?" I asked, trying to sound like I wasn't totally petrified. Malos answered me with a laugh. He turned to Kagan, saying,
"This boy is a spy like his uncle, like this girl."
He walked to Alder and stared him square in the eye.
"And like this traitor Bedouin."
Malos leaned close to Alder until their noses nearly touched. Alder was scared, but tried not to flinch. Malos said,
"I always knew you were a traitor, but I needed you to deliver Pendragon."
Alder dropped his head in shame and embarrassment. Lore struggled in anger to pull away from the two knights who were holding her, but as strong as she was, these huge knights held her tight. To stop her from struggling, one of the knights gave a quick jab with the knife he was holding to her throat. My stomach turned when I saw a trickle of blood flowing down her neck. But Lore wouldn't flinch. She wouldn't let the guy know he had hurt her. I wasn't surprised. Malos then walked to the throne, saying,
"They are all conspiring to incite the Malago into a revolt against us, Your Majesty, and for that they should be put to death."
Things were falling apart, fast. "What do you mean, us?" I shouted at Malos. Then to Kagan I said, "He's not a Bedouin. Ask him where he comes from." Kagan looked at Malos. Was there a hint of doubt in her mind? If I could expose Malos as being a traveler from a different territory, maybe Kagan wouldn't buy everything he had to say. It was a long shot, but the only thing I could think of. "It's true, and I can prove it. Who thought of the trick to get me here?" "It must have been Malos. Nobody else knows how those walkie-talkies work, right? A Bedouin wouldn't know how to use that magic." Kagan looked at the crushed walkie on the floor, then to Malos. I was getting through to her. "Malos isn't a Bedouin," I said with authority. "You can't trust him." She sniffed back her tears, looked at Malos, smiled, and said,
"Of course Malos is not a Bedouin. He came to us many years ago from the far side of the ocean and has been my most trusted advisor ever since. Why do you tell me things I already know?"
Oh, well, so much for my brilliant plan. She already knew. Kagan reached to the table next to her throne and grabbed a piece of purple fruit. It must have been past her feeding time, which was probably every 5 minutes. She took a big, sloppy bite, and a river of purple juice ran down her chin and landed on her ample chest. I wanted to puke. When she spoke, it was with a mouth full of fruit goo. Did I mention I wanted to puke?
"What? Are you trying to get the Malago to make war with us?"
she asked in her squeaky, annoying voice. It was weird. She sounded all innocent, like a 3-year-old asking why the sky is blue. Was it possible that she didn't know how bad the Malago had it? Was Malos really the guy who was calling the shots and using this creepy child woman like a puppet? I figured I'd better answer carefully. "Because they have horrible lives," I said. "They live in dirty mud huts and they don't have enough food. If they don't mine enough glaze, they are murdered. But the worst thing is, they're dying. The air in the mines is poisoning them. They want to fight because they are desperate for better lives." That about summed it up. I didn't want to accuse the Bedouin of taking advantage of them. That might get her mad. But I wanted to paint a picture of how bad the Malago had it. If her royal chubness didn't know these things before, maybe now she would think twice about what her people were doing and have a little sympathy. She took another juicy bite from her purple fruit and stared at me. What was she thinking? Alder and Lore watched her, waiting for her reaction. Malos looked bored. Kagan then tossed the juicy, wet fruit pit on the floor. Instantly, a Novan servant appeared from behind the throne, cleaned up the pit, then disappeared again. No wonder this woman was so fat. She didn't have to lift a finger to do anything. Kagan then said innocently,
That is how it has always been. The Malago dig for glaze so that the Bedouin can trade it for lovely things. It has been this way forever.
Wow! Could she really be so clueless? She didn't think there was anything wrong with the Malago suffering and dying for them. I glanced to Lore, and she had the same look of dumbfounded surprise on her face that I'm sure I had. Alder just kept looking down at the floor. I think he already knew where Kagan's head was. I wasn't sure of what to do next, but I had to say something. "And what do the Bedouin do for the Malago in return for their hard work?" I asked. Kagan cocked her head in surprise, as if I were asking something she had never thought of before. It reminded me of the way Marley turns her head and her ears go up when she hears a strange sound. Before answering, Kagan reached for another piece of purple fruit and started gnawing on it. She made these little grunting, slurping sounds that turned my stomach. What a pig! The whole while she gazed off into the distance, as if she were giving some serious thought to the question I had asked. I couldn't wait to hear the answer, because from what I saw, the Bedouin do nothing for the Malago except abuse them. Alder and Lore waited for the answer as well. Even Malos looked at the queen in anticipation. Kagan took another messy bite of her fruit, swallowed, then looked right at me and said,
"Your questions make my head hurt."
She then looked at Malos and said,
"Kill them."
Whoa, bad response. Instantly the knights grabbed me and started dragging me and Lore and Alder toward the door. Lore put up the best fight. She screamed back at Kagan, "It does not matter what happens to us. The Malago will not be slaves forever." That was very bold and all, but I was kind of thinking it did matter what happened to us. The knights dragged us out into the corridor and toward the stairs when I heard Malos calling from behind.
"Wait,"
he shouted.
"I wish to speak with that one."
That meant me. The knights stopped dragging me along and Malos approached us. He looked at me for a long while, as if sizing me up.
"Remember what happens here today, Pendragon," he said seriously. "This is how it will be. There is no hope for you. Hala will fall, and you will fall with it."
He then looked at the knights and ordered,
"Take them to the box."
As the knights dragged me away, Malos called,
"Remember, Pendragon."
What was he talking about? I expected him to say something like, "The Malago are doomed," or "You will all die a horrible death," or some other nastiness. But instead, what he said made no sense. What is Hala? Osa had said something about Hala before she died, but I had no idea what she was talking about. More important, if I was about to die, then why did he tell me to remember what was going to happen? The way things were going, I wasn't going to live long enough to have time to forget. Believe it or not, as scared as I was, Malice's words gave me hope. They reminded me that this was actually a larger battle than it seemed. It wasn't just about the Malago and the Bedouin. It was about the future of the whole territory of Denderon. If Malos threatened that he would always defeat me, then he must expect there to be more battles. And maybe that meant he wasn't planning to kill us after all. At least, that's what I hoped. The knights dragged the three of us to the circular stairway. I expected them to bring us down to the prison area, but instead, we went up. We climbed one more flight of stairs, and were then hurried down a wide corridor to a wooden door with a heavy lock. One of the knights pulled out a big old key, opened the door, and shoved us inside. Behind us, the door slammed with a booming crash, and we found ourselves in the dark. I think we were all too stunned and scared to look around. Not that there was anything to see.
"Is this it?" asked Lore, sounding bold as ever. "Is this where we will die?"
"No,"
said Alder.
"This is not where we will die."
Alder seemed pretty calm about the whole thing. It was strange. Alder was a pretty nervous guy in general, but now he acted all casual in the face of certain death. I guess of the three of us, I was the only one who was actually scared. No fair.
How come you're so calm? I asked.
I didn't like his answer. He said,
Because this is the holding area. Nothing will happen to us here. When they are ready, they will bring us to the horror.
I guess that meant Alder wasn't being casual. He was in a state of shock. He knew this was the calm before the storm. Something was coming, and the thought of it was so horrible that it frightened him far beyond the point of showing nervousness.
What will they do to us? Asked Lore.
She didn't have to wait for an answer. A door creaked open on the far side of the room and bathed the place in bright sunshine. Once the sun came in, I saw this was a cell, with shackles on the walls and leg irons on the floor. Two knights in full battle gear stood at the open door. One of them motioned for us to come outside. We knew we had no choice, so we walked toward the sunlight. Lore took the lead, but before she went, she turned to us and said,
I will not die without taking some of those Bedouin animals with me.
She then turned and left, with Alder and I close behind. When we stepped into the sunshine, I was blinded and had to shade my eyes. Before they adjusted, I got a strange feeling. I think maybe it was the sound, but I had the feeling we weren't alone. Once my eyes adjusted, I realized that not only weren't we alone, we were standing in a huge stadium along with thousands of other people. This was the Bedouin version of a sports arena. It was open air. Above our heads was blue sky. We were on the top level of the Bedouin palace. 2 days before, when I had looked across the inlet to the bluff above the palace, I thought it was just barren land. But now I realized that from where I was, I couldn't look down into this arena that was dug below the surface. The stadium was square. It reminded me of one of those arenas where they play tennis matches. My guess was that the place could seat a few thousand people. And it was packed. Each side of the arena held a different tribe. One side was all Bedouin. They sat on cushioned seats with pillows for their backs. The next section was taken up by the Novan servants who sat on long bleachers. It was odd seeing so many of these pure white doll people in their white uniforms. The next section was full of Malago. It was obvious they were Malago because of their filthy leather clothes and the fact that they weren't even allowed to sit. They had to stand on stone tiers. My guess was they entered the arena from above, since they weren't allowed to walk through the palace. The fourth side was nearly empty. Halfway up the stands, there was a box with a throne. Obviously, this was where Kagan sat. There were high walls with spikes built between the sections, so there was no way the tribes could mingle. But even if the Malago wanted to get a little rowdy, they couldn't because there were armed knights ringing the top of the stadium. They stood as sentries, lining the entire top tier with their spears at the ready. We stood in a section right next to the playing field below Kagan's box. There were no seats here, only a low barrier between us and the field. At least, I thought it was a playing field, but I wasn't exactly sure what game they played here. The flat area was about the size of a baseball diamond. The surface was grass, but there weren't any lines or markings that would show the boundaries for a game. It was just a plain grass field. I looked up at the various tribes in the stands and saw that each group acted very differently. The Bedouin were chatting and seemed relaxed. Some smiled, others laughed. There were kids, too. It had the feel of a baseball stadium before a game. The Novans sat quietly looking down at the field. Most had their hands crossed in their laps politely and didn't move a muscle. Their faces were blank. I couldn't tell if they were happy to be here or not. The Malago were much easier to read. They were restless. They kept glancing up at the guards that surrounded the stadium. It was obvious that they weren't here by choice, and it wasn't for entertainment. Unfortunately, I was afraid that Lore and Alder and I were the main attraction. I leaned over to Alder and asked, "What kind of game do they play here?" Alder's eyes were riveted on the playing field.
"This is no game, Pendragon,"
he said softly. Before I could ask any more, I heard chimes. They were three simple notes that sounded like they came from a loud but pleasant xylophone. All eyes turned to the empty viewing box above the playing field. I looked up, too, and saw two knights walk out into the box, followed by Malos, who was followed by Kagan. She didn't wave to the crowd or anything the way you would expect a queen to acknowledge her subjects. She just lumbered to her throne and plopped herself down like a bored, spoiled little kid. She was eating again, too. Big surprise. It looked like she was gnawing on a turkey leg. The entire stadium was now quiet, except for the slurping and grunting sounds as Kagan finished off her latest snack. I really would have been grossed out, except for the fact that I knew whatever was going to happen was going to happen soon. My heart started racing. I'm not sure what would have been worse, knowing our fate or not. The fear of the unknown was terrifying. Either way, though, the show was about to begin. Kagan looked up to Malos and said impatiently,
"Well?"
Malos took a few steps forward and motioned down to the playing field. Instantly, I saw a small door open on the opposite side of the field. A few seconds later, somebody was pushed out from inside and tumbled down onto the grass. Obviously, this guy didn't want to be here. In a few seconds, I realized who it was. The scrawny Malago prisoner who was in Uncle Press's cell. I guess he didn't get away when he had the chance. The poor guy looked scared. He pulled himself to his feet and looked around the stadium while shielding his eyes from the suns. As if on cue, the Bedouin spectators let out a loud, football-like cheer. This startled the guy, and he stumbled away from them to the center of the field. At the same time, the Novans applauded politely. There was no yelling or whistling from them, just polite applause that ended as quickly as it began. The Malago didn't do anything but watch in silence. The guy backed to the center of the field, because it was the one place where he could be the farthest away from everybody. He stood in the center, alone, his eyes darting around the stands with confusion and fear. He seemed to be looking for help. Then his eyes finally fell on me. That's where he stopped. It was creepy. I didn't know what to do. Was I the only familiar face in the crowd? Did he want me to wave or something? I looked back at him, feeling helpless. Then something strange happened. He was a bent-over old guy who had a rounded back that I assumed came from working in the mines his whole life. But as he stood staring at me, the fear left his face. He stood up straight, pushed his shoulders back, then touched his heart and held out his hand toward me. He even gave me a small smile. I know this sounds bizarro, but I felt that somehow by seeing me, he got some kind of strength. Believe me, I have no idea why it happened. It's not like I did anything or could help him, but after he saw me, it was like he transformed. Whatever was about to happen, he was now ready, and I played some small part in that. We didn't have to wait long to find out what was in store for the guy. On the right side of the arena from where we were sitting was a door that was larger than the one the Malago just came through. Two knights ran across the grass field toward it. There was a big brass latch that was so heavy it took two of these big knights to release it. Once the latch was undone, they threw the door open and ran for the stands. The scene reminded me of movies I'd seen of bullfights. I looked into the dark recesses beyond this large open door and expected to see a bull come charging through. As it turns out, I wasn't that far off. I heard movement and snarls beyond that door. All eyes were riveted on the opening, including Lore's and Alder's. Even the Bedouin stopped their socializing for a moment to look with anticipation. A quig beast leaped through the doorway and crouched down on all fours. The Bedouin section let out a cheer. The Novans applauded again, and the Malago cringed. Some hid their eyes. Others stood straight, as if the least they could do for their fellow tribesmen was to honor him by having the courage to watch. The Quig scanned the arena with yellow hunter's eyes, ready to spring as soon as it found quarry. It curled its black lips back from its teeth to reveal sharp rows of deadly fangs. Even from where I was, I could see drool dripping down its chin in anticipation of the hunt. My mind quickly flashed back to the Quig that Uncle Press nailed with the spear, and of how the other ravenous Quigs devoured one of their own, ripping its flesh from the bone while it was still alive. I glanced up at Kagan, who stared intently at the Quig with a smile on her face. Without taking her eyes off the animal, she took a huge bite out of her turkey leg. At once the idea of a bullfight left me. This wasn't like a bullfight at all. This was like one of those Roman Colosseum spectacles where they threw the Christians to the lions. The Bedouin wanted to see blood. Their wish was about to come true. The Malago prisoner had remained still ever since the Quig had entered the arena. And why not? There was nothing for him to do. He was too frail to fight and had no place to run. Malos made a gesture to one of the knights near the arena floor, and the knight threw something to the Malago. It was one of those stick weapons like Lore used. But there was no way the Malago miner could use this puny weapon to defend himself. I think it was given to him in hopes of having the battle last more than a few seconds. That's the best the guy could hope for. He picked up the weapon, but just from the way he held it, I knew that he had no clue how to use it. He might as well have had a pillow to fight off the Quig. The coiled Quig sniffed the air. It had caught scent of the Malago. Its body tensed, zeroing in on its prey. I looked up to Kagan and saw that she had put her turkey leg down and was leaning over the rail in anticipation. Malos stood behind her with his hands clasped behind his back. He turned and looked right at me. I looked away. I didn't want to see this guy anymore. Then the Quig attacked. It crouched back on its legs like a cat and sprang at the poor Malago miner. The Malago turned and ran. It was heartbreaking and horrifying. He ran to the side of the arena, but there was no safety there. So he started to run around the circle with the wooden weapon dragging behind him. Lore couldn't take it. She made a move to jump out and rescue the doomed miner, but the instant she took a step, Alder stopped her. It was a good thing, too. She wouldn't have much more of a chance against this beast than the scraggly miner. The Malago in the stands watched silently. I could see the agony on their faces. The Novans watched silently as well. I couldn't tell how they felt about what was going on. Then I looked to the Bedouin. The horrible thing was, these people were laughing. The sight of a Malago miner running for his life was a big joke. The Quig kept its distance from the Malago miner, almost playing with him like a cat plays with a mouse before killing it. After a few moments, the Malago miner realized it was futile to run around the ring, so he stopped and turned back to face the beast. He raised the wooden stick, but there wasn't a person watching these events who thought it would help him beat back the vicious animal. Time seemed to stand still. The Malago stood with the stick weapon at the ready. The Quig crouched a few feet away, swaying its massive head. Everyone in the stadium held their breath. And then the Quig jumped. The Malago miner held up his stick to defend himself. The last thing I saw was that the Quig swept it out of the way with a mighty swing of his clawed paw. The stick flew across the arena, and when it landed, I was horrified to see that the Malago miner's hand was still clutching it. I looked up toward Kagan and the other Bedouin. What I saw there was almost as horrible as the carnage that was taking place in the arena. Kagan sat forward on her chair and clapped her hands with glee like a little girl watching clown tricks. The other Bedouin were laughing uproariously, as if this were some kind of slapstick comedy. And through it all, I could hear the sounds of the quig tearing at the flesh of the Malago miner. The doomed man gave one quick yelp, and then he was silent. Luckily, he died quickly. All that was left was the feeding. It turned my stomach and made me hate the Bedouin even more for their total lack of compassion for another living being. Malos looked at me and smiled. This may have been the most horrible moment of all, because I felt in that second that he had staged this whole spectacle for my benefit. The idea that I may have been responsible for this in any way made my stomach hurt. The show was over quickly. I knew it was done because the Bedouin applauded as if the quig had just staged a fine performance. The Novans applauded politely as well, though with much less enthusiasm than the Bedouin. The Malago just watched in horror. A few of them were crying. Then a few more chimes sounded. Instantly, six knights rushed into the ring with ropes. Three of them held spears on the quig, while the others lassoed its neck and began to drag it back toward the large door. Now that it had fed, it was much more calm than before. It actually went without a fight. I saw the blood dripping from its jaws as it was led back to the door leading to the quig pens. I looked back to the spot where it had attacked the Malago miner. All that was left of the poor man was a wet, red spot on the grass. A Bedouin knight filled a wooden bucket with water from a faucet near the quig pen, then quickly rushed over to the spot of the kill and poured it on the blood. The water and blood sank into the grass, as if they had never been there. Then two more chimes sounded, and a terrifying thought came to me. We were next! We had been shown what our fate would be, and now it was our turn. I looked around, expecting the knights to prod us into the arena. But they didn't. I looked up to Malos to see what he was doing. He looked back at me and pointed to the sky. I looked up and realized what would happen next. In the sky, the three suns were about to converge on each other. It was the equinox. Then I heard another door open inside the arena. It was the same door where the doomed Malago miner tumbled out before. But there were no more Malago to be executed today. What I saw at that door made my heart sink. A man stepped out into the sunlight, standing up straight, with his head held high. I think I actually gasped when I saw him. It was Uncle Press. It was the equinox, and he was the next to die.
Journal number 3. Continued. Denduron.
Uncle Press walked defiantly to the center of the killing ring. It was only a few days since I had seen him last, but with all that had happened, it felt like it had been months. It was strange to see him dressed in the leather skins of the Malago. I was used to seeing him wearing jeans and his long coat that would flap in the wind as he rode his motorcycle. But things had changed. Though he was still Uncle Press, he also looked like any other Malago miner, with his three-day-old beard and messed-up hair. But unlike the other Malago, Uncle Press had an air of confidence. The Bedouin stopped talking and laughing. There was now tension in their section of the stands, as if this newest gladiator was going to prove to be more of a match than the last. I looked to the Malago spectators and saw that they were watching his arrival in pretty much the same way. But rather than the look of fear they had for the poor Malago prisoner who had just been devoured, they now seemed to have hope that maybe, just maybe, the visiting team might have a shot here. Only the Novans reacted the exact same way as before. They gave Uncle Press some polite, emotionless applause. Even though Uncle Press looked all sorts of confident,
It was going to take more than confidence to beat a charging, hungry Quig. Still, something about the way Uncle Pris carried himself gave you the feeling that if any man could beat a Quig, it would be this one. He stood in the center of the field and looked up at all the spectators. He did a 360 turn and stopped when he laid eyes on the Bedouin section. I could see that he was shaking his head and knew what he was thinking. It disturbed him to think that these people were gathered to watch blood sport. In the royal box, Kagan didn't sense any of this tension. She was being her normal oblivious self as she sat on her throne, gnawing her turkey leg. Malos leaned down and whispered something in her ear. Kagan answered with a shrug that told me she didn't care one way or the other about what Malos had asked her. Malos bowed to her royal chubbness, then stepped to the front of the box and surveyed the people in the stadium. He raised his hands, and all eyes immediately went to him. Even Uncle Press looked up to see what this evil puppet master had to say.
"People of Denderon," he bellowed, "the man you see before you has been accused of the high crime of treason. He is guilty of plotting to destroy the peaceful balance of our society and of inciting the Malago into overthrowing the great reign of our beloved Queen Kagan."
When he said this, he looked to Kagan. Kagan acknowledged his look with a loud, deep belch. What a class act. Malos didn't react and continued.
"For this crime, he has been sentenced to death at the equinox, when the light is the strongest, so we can all bear witness to his punishment. Let this execution serve as a reminder that the natural order must never be disrupted. To try and change the normal course of events is a crime against humanity, and punishment will be harsh and swift. Long live Denderon! Long live Queen Kagan! Death to those who oppose the throne!"
Malos then made a motion to the field, and two knights ran across the grass to open the door to let in another Quig. It was clear what this was all about. Malos was using Uncle Pres as an example to scare the Malago out of their rebellion. The Malago trusted Uncle Pres. In seconds, another Quig would leap out of that dark door and attack. It would mean the end of the rebellion and the death of my uncle. And the way things were going, Alder, Lore, and I would be the next victims in the ring. As scared as I was, I realized that there was an even bigger picture unfolding here. Uncle Press had brought us here to try and bring peace to the Bedouin and the Malago. It was a tribal feud that Malos, or Saint Dane, was doing a fine job of fueling. By eliminating Uncle Press and us, there would be nothing to stop the Bedouin from destroying the Malago. The territory of Denderon would fall into chaos, and Malos's evil mission would be complete. That is, unless I did something to stop it. I knew exactly what I had to do. I was scared out of my mind, but still I knew what had to be done. Before I had the chance to chicken out, I jumped over the barrier that separated our box from the field and ran toward my uncle. "Pendragon!" shouted Lore with surprise. I think she was totally shocked that I was the first one to take action for a change. I hadn't told her what my plan was. There wasn't time. But she must have figured I had something in mind, so she and Alder quickly followed after me. "I know what you're thinking, Mark, and you're wrong. I hadn't gone delusional. I hadn't suddenly gotten all hero macho and figured I could whoop up on a Quig. It wasn't like that at all, but I had an idea, and if I was right, it might give us all a chance of getting out of there alive." I ran up to Uncle Press and stood beside him. I expected him to see me and be totally surprised and shout something like, "Bobby, no, go back, save yourself." But he didn't. Instead, he looked down at me as if he were expecting me to show up all along and calmly said,
"I forgot to tell you, that Courtney Chetwynd is pretty cute."
I gotta hand it to the guy. He was cool. Maybe a little crazy, but cool. Lore and Alder quickly joined us.
Lore had scooped up the wooden weapon that the Malago prisoner had used and was ready to wield it. I was glad to see that she had separated it from the guy's severed hand first. Then suddenly a cheer went up from the Bedouin crowd. I knew what that meant. I looked to the